Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello everyone and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I am a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be talking to a writer and editor, Paul Hirsch, the author of A Long Time Ago in a Cutting Room Far, Far Away. He is an editor who has had a huge impact on the industry. He has edited some of the most important films of the last 50 years, including Star Wars, Carrie, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Mission Impossible. The list just goes on and on. Planes, Trains and Automobiles. We've just had Thanksgiving, so there's one. Footloose, Ray, Steel Magnolias, Empire Strikes Back. Unbelievable CV of films. So it's a real honor to talk to him and to hear his stories. Let's stop wasting time. Let's get on with the conversation. Remember though, if you do like the episode, please click on like, subscribe to the podcast if you don't already. Spread the word, tell your friends, tell anybody who might be interested. If you're a writer, write a review. If you're not a writer, if you're just a listener, write a review of the podcast. That would be great. The numbers are going up, and that's really gratifying for me. But it's not for me. It's for my guests. I want my guests to get as much exposure as possible from these conversations because I think they're really fascinating. So I hope you do too. You can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Jonty, DrJonty. But before you do any of that, let's dive in straight away with the conversation.
I have a long history with Italy. I haven't been as much as I'd like to be, but parlo italiano, l'ho studiato all'università quando ero giovane e sono andato qualche volte. But it's been a long time since I was speaking it, you know.
Lei parla benissimo.
Grazie. Grazie tanto. Allora parliamo italiano oggi.
Mi piacerebbe, ma purtroppo i nostri ascoltatori sono... Ci sono gli italiani, però. C'è Andrea che ascolta. So, ciao, Andrea. Congratulations on the memoir. It was a really fascinating, absolutely fascinating read. It felt like a trip through film history to some degree, in the sense that you were kind of there... for so much of that, those years of
some of the best films that we've had.
Long time ago in a cutting room far, far away.
Maybe that's where we can start, because your CV is, your filmography is so full of so many great films. But of course, with that title, you're referring to perhaps the most famous in terms of Star Wars.
Well, it's the one that, you know, most people have heard of most. And, you know, I knew that when I wrote the book, that would be the chapter that everyone was most interested in. And it happened early in my career. So I decided to ignore the second and pay attention to the first idea, which is that that's what people wanted to read about most. So I put it in the title.
It's so interesting. It's sort of like, as you're writing the book, it's like the same skills that you have as an editor are coming in. Of you know, I don't necessarily have to go completely chronologically. I can put this here and then this here. Did you feel those skills sort of aligning?
Editing the book was very familiar, but I have to hasten to add that I had some very good help editing the book, and that I originally started out writing the book non-chronologically, and found myself writing. I had met so-and-so earlier when I was, and I was doing a lot of explaining how I'd met this person, how we knew each other. And I thought, this is getting so complicated. I'll just do it chronologically. And because that was the simplest way to tell the story. And frankly, in this day and age, I feel that the use of the flashback is overused. There's hardly a show you can, or a movie you can watch that doesn't have cut to the backstory, you know, a flashback, often without handrails for the audience. You sort of have to figure out yourself, for yourself, that you're in a different time. But I didn't want to, I wanted to tell the story straightforwardly. And then my literary agent said, you have to get to Carrie by page 50. And I said, why? He said, well, Carrie is the first movie that people will have heard of that you did, and you have to get it in the first 50 pages. I said, why? And he said, well, the readers for the publishing houses only read the first 50 pages of any manuscript. I thought, great. So I looked at my text and I didn't get to Carrie till page 90 or something. I said, well, I can't cut that stuff out. You know, how I got into the business is the question I get asked most. You know, how did you get into it? That's the thing people are, you know, really interested in. And my editor, a woman named Jennifer Shute, made the brilliant and cinematic suggestion that we start with Carrie and then, you know, then pick up the story and then go back, you know. So it was not for it was not for aesthetic reasons, but for practical reasons. But it worked beautifully because, as I said before, I thought that, you know, the chapter on Star Wars would be what people would be most interested in. Star Wars happened to follow Carrie in my filmography. And, you know, I went directly from working on Carrie to Star Wars. And so I get to the end of the Carrie chapter. I'm on my way to go work on Star Wars. And then I go to the next chapter, which originally had been the first chapter, and I retitled it 10 years earlier. So that's how that worked out. But, you know, but this is the kind of thing that you do when you're editing a movie. You sort of improvise based on whatever the influences are, you know.
Well, absolutely. I was going to say, this sort of practical decision making, where it's, you know, there's the art and the commerce and the, you know, satisfying what the director wants as well, obviously. But it doesn't seem to be one specific thing. It seems to be I want to use an Italian now. We started speaking in Italian, an insieme, an altogether of things.
Yeah, it was not a purely aesthetic choice. Although I was happy with it, you know, I was happy with the way it worked out. It had not been my instinct. Anyway.
Hmm. And so you mentioned the question earlier, and for our listeners who haven't yet had the opportunity of reading your memoir, how did you get into the business?
Oh, well, I had thought of, you know, I went to Columbia University in New York, and when it was time to graduate, I had to figure out a way to stay in school because the Vietnam War was going on and I would get a student deferment. And at that time, everyone was either going to med school or law school or business school, and I didn't want to do any of those. And there was also journalism school, which was really not for me. And I never considered I had any skill at writing. So I'm always kind of struck when people say they enjoyed my writing in the book. Some do. And it's always surprising to me. But anyway, there was also architecture school. And I thought, well, that's interesting. I'd been an art history major. And I thought, well, I like architecture. That can be something interesting. So I applied and I was accepted. But I didn't have enough credits to graduate Columbia without taking a summer course. And I needed a few, I think I needed a few more credits. And I was able to get into a program in Paris where I was able to get the required credits and spend June and half of July in Paris on the left bank. And the classes went for half a day. And I had from noon on to myself and wandering around the left bank, I would see these art theaters showing American movies. And it would say Raoul Walsh Film Festival. And I would think, who is Raoul Walsh? And it would say Howard Hawks Film Festival. And I thought, who is Howard Hawks? And I started going to these movies. And they were movies from the 40s and, mostly 40s and the 30s. And it was a revelation to see Hollywood movies, which in our day back then were considered just mere entertainment, were regarded by the French as art. And around that time, the Cinémathèque was showing an Orson Welles series. And I went to see, on Monday, I went to see Citizen Kane. I had heard the title, but I didn't know anything about it. And I went to see it, and it was a print that was not subtitled in French. It was the original English. The place was packed. I don't think everyone there spoke English, but I think they went to see the lighting and the staging and the music and so forth and the cutting. And anyway, it got to the end and, the end just knocked me over. It was just fantastic. One of the great endings in all of film history. So the next night I went back and I saw the Magnificent Ambersons. Wednesday was... The Lady from Shanghai, Thursday was Touch of Evil, and Friday they were showing, I think it was Othello, and Welles was going to appear in person, and you couldn't get near the place. I couldn't get in. But anyway, those films by Welles sort of awakened an interest I had in movies. I always loved movies. And in the fall, I went back to New York and started at architecture school. And I decided that I just had enough of school. I was enrolled in a 4-year bachelor's degree again. I had already gotten a BA, and I was facing 4 years to get a Bachelor of Architecture. And I just didn't want to do that. And simultaneously, a friend of mine was working in the Columbia University neighborhood, editing a small documentary. And he had in his apartment, and I went and visited him, and I saw a moviola for the first time. Now, in 1966, there was no such thing as videotape, at least for the public. The networks had them, of course. But the only way you could see a moving image in those days was by going to the movies or by turning on the television, and you saw it only live, going forward at sound speed. There was no such thing as pause or rewind or fast forward. None of those things existed. And here was a machine, the moviola, that could stop on a frame and go back. And I was astounded. I thought, wow, this is so cool. And I decided I wanted to, and I saw all the tools and the equipment. I always liked working with my hands. And I saw, splicers and synchronizers and reels and rewinds and all the various, different colored grease pencils and different colored tapes and boxes. And I, it's sort of an arts and crafts aspect of film editing in those days that appealed to me. And I decided I wanted to pursue it. And I didn't know anything more about it except that it looked cool. That was all I knew. Excuse me. So I dropped out of architecture school and I got a job delivering packages for a small industrial film company. And I would take the work print from the editors in the office over to the negative cutter. And I would pick up the cut negative from the negative cutter and take it to the lab for printing. And then I'd pick up the prints from the lab and bring them back to the office and mount them on reels and send them out to whoever they were intended for. So I sort of was acting as a gopher, you know, for a couple of weeks. And I met one of the guys that I met on my rounds was a negative cutter. He was looking to hire somebody to train. And I went back and I spoke to one of the editors. I said, "What do you think? I've been offered this job." And he said, "Well, you'd be handling film and not packages." And I thought, well, that's a good point, you know. So after 2 weeks, I gave them 2 weeks notice and I went to work for this negative cutter. And I worked for him for about 6 months. I learned the whole technical end of the business, how you prepare a negative for printing and how you have to drop frames in order to make a splice and various things that were useful and important to know. But after a while, I stopped learning and it became repetitive. And it's a very boring job. You can't make any mistakes. You know, you have to be very focused on something that's really boring. So I decided I would, and the guy was a screamer too. So he screamed at me once too often. I said, "Screw this," and I left. And then I got a job as an assistant editor, which I wasn't, but I knew enough to be an assistant editor at a trailer house. And the editor there was working alone at that point, needed an assistant. And after a couple of months there, he was getting more work than he could handle. So he gave me something to cut. And the client was United Artists. They liked what I did. And it was a 10-minute documentary on the making of the Thomas Crown Affair. They needed cut down to 3.5 minutes. So I did that. They liked it. They gave me another one to do. And then from then on, I was cutting. These are called featurettes, documentaries about the making of. And I was cutting featurettes and trailers for a while. And then my brother had a job at Universal as a low-level, entry-level executive, scouting, writing, and directing talent in the New York area. And if you were a young filmmaker looking for money from Universal, you would go to him and pitch a project. And one of these young directors who came to him was Brian De Palma. And they went to Universal with a project that my brother liked, and Universal rejected it. So during his two-week vacation from his job, he raised money independently, and he and Brian shot this movie, Greetings. And among the three, it was about three young guys trying to get out of the draft. And Greetings was the way the draft letter, if you got a letter in the mail and it said greetings, you knew you were being drafted. That was the standard opening line. So one of the three actors was about three young guys, and one of them was Robert De Niro. And so anyway, the picture needed a trailer. So they came to me and I cut a trailer for them. And that's how I met Brian. And he and I hit it off, and the picture did fairly well. And I think they won the Silver Bear at the Berlin Film Festival, or Brian won it rather. Second prize for first time, the young director or whatever. And they got the money to do a sequel that was originally entitled Son of Greetings, but changed the title to Hi Mom. And that was my first film. I was 23 years old.
That film is so of its time as well. It so much feels like a 1960s, like everything is possible. I rewatched it recently, after reading your book, and was watching out for for the things that you talked about in the book as well. And it feels like such a daring and radical film, so the sort of film that we don't see enough of perhaps these days.
Yeah, I mean, when I watch it, I saw a film recently, I can't remember what it was now, but it gave me the same feeling as my mom, where it was like young guys who were just, let's make a movie, you know, it's like the excitement of making a movie. Yeah, it was very disorganized. I mean, there was no script. Brian was working from a handful of, you know, pages he had scribbled some notes on. The first cut was way too long, but we didn't know that, and allowed the producer to see it with disastrous results. But I learned a lot. You know, I went into it knowing nothing, but the saving grace was I didn't know that I knew nothing. So I went into the project with the confidence of ignorance. You know, I thought, yeah, I can do this, no problem. And I didn't know that I knew nothing. But anyway, it was a great way to start. I didn't get another picture for 3 years. And I filled in again by doing trailers and small films. And then Brian got the money to do Sisters, needed an editor, and hired me. And at that point, it really, you know, got the ball rolling.
And there's also a problem, isn't there, in terms of, so you know, there's it's something that that is detailed throughout the book as well, in order to get into working in the Hollywood system, you have to have a certain amount of experience, but to get the experience, you have to already be inside the system.
Yeah, it's the catch-22.
For quite a while, you were sort of hovering, sort of doing stuff in New York and moving between the two, right?
Yeah, well, I didn't work in Hollywood until after Star Wars. So I did 5 pictures with Brian before anybody else hired me, and that was George. But, you know, Brian was having some success and getting more and more money and getting financing from studios. So I was sort of worked into the system working with him, although I was only working in New York. So I wasn't really part of the Hollywood machine quite yet, you know.
That point, your relationship with Brian is a real interesting sort of thread, a narrative that goes all the way through the book almost. I mean, it's interrupted at certain points. You're going off and you're working with different people, of course, but it sort of is a bit of a continuous theme as well.
Well, you know, we worked really well together, and Brian was my mentor. He was he put his confidence in me, and he encouraged me, and he empowered me, and you know, it was a great boon to me. And of course, he introduced me to all his friends who were part of the, you know, what the French call the American New Wave, you know, or the New Wave of the 70s. So I recently was on a book tour through Francophone Europe. I was in France and Belgium and Switzerland, met a lot of people at cinematheques and film schools, and they've sort of lumped me in with, you know, because of my connection with De Palma and Lucas, and I almost worked for Spielberg and Scorsese, although I wasn't available when they called. Because I knew all these guys back then, they sort of lumped me in with them, which is fine with me, you know.
You'll accept that company.
Yeah, it was okay. But yeah, of course, they all knew each other, and I knew them all, and, you know, we were all about the same age, you know, within a few years, and all part of this. It really was a kind of a new wave sweeping into Hollywood.
Yeah, it seems like a fascinating atmosphere, and it seems like something that's very open to lots of different ideas. You know, obviously, all these guys are amazingly sort of film literate, but there's also a sort of interest in ideas generally. There seems to be a ferment of stuff going on.
Yeah, well, they all had very different sensibilities, but they all shared a love and passion for movies. I'm not sure that still exists today. I don't know. I've been out of the business for a number of years now. And, you know, these days, a year is like a decade used to be. So I think it changed fast.
One thing I wanted to ask, just going back to your Orson Welles sort of, your private Orson Welles season in Paris. I mean, his films are notoriously, except for Citizen Kane, they're notorious for sort of this idea that the editor has you know betrayed the vision that he had. How do you feel about that now, and how did you feel about it when you were watching them at the time? It probably wasn't even sort of common knowledge necessarily.
Well, I had no understanding of editing or what it was. I mean, in Citizen Kane, it becomes quite clear that, you know, the dinner sequence where the years go by where they're at the table, and it's breakfast, I guess, at the breakfast table year after year, and it's sort of collapsed time with that sort of montage. But I wasn't really aware of editing. I mean, I was also passionately enthusiastic about Breathless, and I didn't know why. You know, there was just something about it that attracted me. I didn't learn about Wells's problems with the studio until much, much later. You know, I was completely a naive audience in those days. What happened with Magnificent Ambersons, which was the first picture that Wells did after Citizen Kane, was that the Citizen Kane, I think, was 1941, I believe. And it was the start of the war, and the State Department had organized a program to try to get the South, the Latin American countries to side with the Allies. They were, I think, Brazil and Argentina were neutral, and I forget, I don't know exactly the history of the politics at the time, but they organized this film program where they subsidized Hollywood directors to go to various countries, make films in collaboration with the South Americans in order to strengthen the political ties. And Wells went off to Rio de Janeiro, went off to Brazil to film, to make a film. And he was going to make this film about, an event, a historic event in Brazil, in which some impoverished fishermen from the north, which is in the north, it's, you know, closer to the equator, so it's a poorer area. They put together a raft and sailed the raft down to Rio de Janeiro and into the harbor to protest their living situation. And they became national heroes, and they were covered by newsreels and radio. And Wells decided to make a movie about them, and he was going to use non-professionals as actors. And there's a wonderful documentary about it called It's All True.
Which was the name of the film, I think, as well, wasn't it? It was the name he was going to use.
It sounds right. I'm not sure about that. But anyway, he got involved with, he was kind of a wild young man, and there are stories of him throwing furniture out the hotel window onto the Copacabana. He was sort of out of control, and he was spending a lot of money, and the studio, meanwhile, was forging ahead with the post-production of The Magnificent Ambersons. And he wasn't around when they were finishing the film because he was off in South America carrying on and chasing this project. Well, anyway, during the filming of the Wells project, he recreated the raft sailing into Rio de Janeiro with the original heroes playing their parts. And there was an accident and one of them drowned, and it became a huge national story. Wells went in front of the newsreels and cameras and he said, "I swear I will finish this film in honor of, you know, the hero who died." Maybe more than one of them was drowned, I forget. So then he was committed to finishing the film, but he didn't really have a script, and the studio was losing confidence in him and telling him, you know, they were cutting off his money and limiting how much time he could spend down there. So this was all in the context of finishing Magnificent Ambersons. So in terms of the studio destroying his film, well, he wasn't there. He was off, you know, chasing this situation he'd gotten himself into. So it's a very interesting story, but...
And that was kind of common as well in those days anyway. The idea of a director sort of sitting in on the cut in the 1940s was, you know, wasn't... You had people like John Ford actually not shooting stuff because he wanted to sort of edit it in the camera. He didn't want to give them any alternatives.
Yeah, well, it wasn't the way it worked back then. You know, back then the director shot the movie and then the editing department took over, and you had women like Dorothy Spencer or... Margaret Booth, who were the heads of editing departments. There was a woman named Barbara McLean at 20th Century Fox. They would head up these departments. They would assign editors to the picture, and they would oversee the editing along with the studio chief. And the directors were just, you know, they'd finish shooting one picture on Friday and they'd start another one on Monday. So, Ford was famous for trying to protect himself from interference by the studio and try to shoot it in such a way that it can only be cut one way. It's funny, I worked with Brad Bird on Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. Mm. And I noticed that, you know, Brad had been an animator, so he thought, he was a very careful planner, and he would shoot these shots. And I noticed he didn't have much overlap between one shot and the next. A piece of action, you know, he would pick up, and he wasn't covering it terribly much. They understand what I mean. The overlap was very brief. And I would say to him, why don't you let the camera run a little bit more, you know, and then pick it up a little earlier so you have more overlap between the different angles. He said, no, I don't want anyone recutting my stuff, you know. So he had read these stories about Ford, I suppose. We got to the editing of the film, and we were, you know, working together. He'd say, why don't you extend that shot a little bit? And I said, well, I can't because you yelled cut, you know. And then and then he realized that the only person he had foiled was himself. nobody was coming in to recut the picture. It was just...
That's like learning the lessons of a different epoch and sort of being in trouble because of it, I guess.
Yeah, he learned the wrong lesson. And it's a different age, you know, it's a different era. So anyway, Wells was always fighting with the studio.
And when you go onto Star Wars, you're working with Marcia Lucas.
Marcia.
Yeah, you're coming in. You're working with her and exactly. Yeah. So what's the situation when you arrive there? How far along are they with the film?
I was the fourth editor hired on the picture. The first editor was let go when they finished principal photography and left England. And George and Marcia were very unhappy with the cut. She was an editor of, you know, she had edited Taxi Driver and Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. She didn't want to work on Star Wars, but George implored her. He says, you've got to take over, you know, because this cut is hopeless. And she agreed. And they had hired Richard because he lived close to where they were working in San Francisco. And Richard had cut, he had worked on The Conversation and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He was very accomplished. They came through New York on the way back to California, and we were working on Carrie at the time. We had basically finished the cut, and we showed it to George and Marcia, and they went off to California. About 2 weeks later, I got a phone call from Marcia saying, can you come help out? I wanted nothing more. And I agreed, and that's how it turned out. So, but I had to finish Carrie first. So they had finished shooting Star Wars, I want to say around the beginning of July, something like that, or mid-July. So I had to stay on Carrie until the end of September. I wasn't available until then to work on the film. So Marcia started working on the end battle. That was her assignment. She took that on, and Richard started recutting the cut that George was unhappy with of the body of the film.
Right.
And they realized that it wasn't going to go fast enough unless they had more help. So by the time I got on the picture, a lot of work had already been done, you know. So what happened was Marcia kept working on the end battle. I jumped into recutting the reels that with Richard, and we would sort of leapfrog. If he was on reel 2, I would take reel 3, and then he'd go on to 4, and I'd go on to 5, and so forth. I didn't see what he was working on. Well, that's not entirely true. We had agreed when I came on that since we were all working together that, and our names are all going to be on the film, that we would show each other our scenes, and if anybody had any notes that they, you know, if they saw something they were uncomfortable with, discuss it and try and work it out so that everyone was happy about that. So there was a lot of consultation. But it was more like a courtesy consultation, you know. People were inhibited from interfering in other people's work. And it was a little bit of, you know, I had to be very polite, you know.
Right, right.
But it was fine. And at a certain point, George had been getting ILM up off the ground and flying down there half the week. He would go down to Los Angeles on a Monday morning, stay there till Wednesday evening. He worked 3 days at ILM. Wednesday night, he'd fly back. And then Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, he would work with us, the editors. And we worked that way for a while. And then the studio was concerned about expenses on the film and wanted to cut the end battle. They said, you know, they've rescued the princess. The movie's over. You know, you don't need the end battle. And George was determined to have the end battle. So he wanted to put that into work, into the pipeline at ILM first, so that once it got going, you know, it's like getting, you know, slightly pregnant.
Yeah, the costs have been sunk. You have to follow through.
Exactly. So he wanted to finish the end battle first, to get that in the works first, so they couldn't cut it. So ILM gave us a deadline for when they needed the cut. So he took me off what I was doing, and he split the sequence in half. And Marcia took one half. I took the other half. When I say half, I think she had the longer half, if that makes any sense. But he gave me the end, the final trench run, Luke's trench run. So we worked on that separately for a day or two, and then we combined the sequences into one. And then we did a sort of a tag team editing session where I would sit at the cam and drive, and Marcia and George would sit behind me on the couch and make comments, and I'd make suggestions, and we'd work that way for a while. And after a couple of hours, I would give up my seat, and Marcia would drive, and I would sit next to George, and we went on that way for a couple of days, and we locked the sequence and then turned it in. And then I went back to recutting the reels. We had a screening for Alan Ladd Jr., who was the head of the studio, around Christmas time. And the picture was very rough because we had virtually no visual effects. Mm. And we had placeholder shots instead of the effects that were still not made yet. And it was very hard to interpret, even for us who were working on it. And I wondered what he thought of it. And the lights came on at the end, and he said, "Great." So I don't know if he thought, you know, like you said, sunk costs, you know, I guess he thought in for a penny, in for a pound. He said, "Great." And we went on. And then my contract was to the end of the year. So Marcia came to speak to me, and I thought she was going to.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Say, thank you very much, goodbye, and good luck. But she didn't. What she told me was that Marty Scorsese's editor had died. The editor who was working on New York, New York, and Marty had asked her to come down to LA and take over the film. And she really wanted to do that because it was a character film. And she was, you know, much more in tune with her sensibilities, not this, you know, spaceship rocket, you know, space gun, ray gun kind of movie. So she wanted to go work on that. And George had said that he wanted to finish the picture with just one editor, and he wanted it to be me. So I was surprised at that because Richard had been hired before me. I assumed that he was going to be on the picture at the end, but his deal was the same as mine. It was only till the end of the year. So George left himself the option to hire one of us, and he hired me. So at that point, beginning of January to the end, which was, you know, mid-May, I was the editor on the film.
What was the what was the moment where, because I mean, you're editing Carrie before this, and you're editing Sisters and Brian's films. So when you looked at this film, it was it's so different from what you were doing with De Palma. What was your sort of, did it take you a while to acclimatize to it, and what were your feelings towards the film? You know, that famously, as you say, Alan Ladd Jr., you know, gave you a sort of thumbs up of a certain kind, but famously lots of people saw this film early stages and were very dismissive, you know, didn't think this was going to work.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was great. I mean, I had seen production stills at a friend's house in New York, and I was just knocked out. I mean, I saw pictures of the, you know, C-3PO and R2-D2 and Chewbacca and the Sandcrawler and the Stormtroopers and Darth Vader. And these were black and white stills, but, you know, on the set, production stills. And I just thought it was a knockout. And we had dinner at their house, and I came back home that night, and I said to my wife, I said, you know, I really would love to work on this movie. But it seemed impossible. But no two people have the same sensibility. Of course, obviously, Brian and George are very far apart in that sense. But I don't fully share Brian's sensibility either, you know. And one of the reasons that I was so excited about it was to be able to work with somebody who had a different sensibility. And, I appreciate Brian and everything he did for me. And I think he's brilliant at what he does. Nobody moves the camera better or conceives better visual sequences than Brian, but he's not that interested in performance. I mean, the actors are not his medium. It's more the camera and the editing. And for an editor, it's great, you know, but there's some, you know, macabre aspects to Brian's soul, and I didn't fully share those. But, and I didn't, you know, I just done Carrie, which is a horror picture, and I didn't want to do just horror pictures. And in fact, the next picture Brian did was another sort of horror picture, The Fury. And, you know, I didn't feel I could turn it down. So I signed on. But it's not my, you know, he was describing the film to me. He says, and at the end, his head explodes. I thought, really? This is what you want to do? You want to make a movie where a guy's head explodes? But I agreed to do it because he had been so important in my life and so, done so much for me in my career. I didn't feel I could turn him down, but it's not me, you know. But the editor is, that's not my job. Is, you know, my job is to help the director realize his vision or her vision, I must hasten to add.
And yet, I mean, that's what's interesting about the memoir as well, is that as you go through your career, there are so many times where you have sort of different relationships with different directors and different, I mean, it's almost like it's almost a different job to some degree, that you're helping out much more with the story. You're visiting the set and you're meeting them, and you know, those personalities are kind of very important in how you can work and sometimes how you can't work.
Well, you know, directors are as different as any people are different from each other. So you have to make relationships, you know, with who they are. Relationships are going to be different, of course, with each one. There are people I did not get along with who are not in the book.
But you can tell us now.
You can look in my filmography and see who's not in the book and figure it out.
I'm thumbing through IMDb as we speak. No, I'm joking. I'm joking. I have to thank you, by the way, because Star Wars was my first ever trip to the cinema. With my dad, with my dad and my brother, 1977 in Barrow-in-Furness in Cumbria in the north of England. We queued outside. It was a genuine blockbuster, and that we queued out right round the block to the swimming pool.
Of course.
It was winter, so it was dark because it didn't get up north until the winter, and it was a sold out screening, so absolutely it took us so long to actually get into the cinema that the film had already started. So I never saw that front crawl bit or anything. How old was I? I was 6 years old.
Six.
Yeah. Yeah. I was a little kid, but I still to this day remember being terrified of Darth Vader.
I was going to say, I think Fix is kind of young for this movie.
I guess it was, but I was just so it was unbelievable. I mean, can you imagine? It was the first film I saw on the big screen as well. So it was like. Yeah. But the thing was, then we didn't get to see it again. It didn't play on television until 1982. And so, I was 10 by the time it came to show on television. And in the meantime, I had to read the books. I had to play with the action figures. So it was very, it's very, very big for me in that way.
Great.
And listened to the record and the soundtrack and everything. So thanks for that. That was a great experience. But then obviously you're going on and you're having, I mean, the list of films is phenomenal. And some of those films, as I was saying earlier, you're having a huge impact on. I love the story about Footloose and about, suggesting another song and suggesting how to do the sort of the feat of the title sequence.
Herbert Ross was a highly respected studio director. And I think it's funny, on this recent trip I made through Europe, his name wasn't very well known. His work isn't highly regarded. I mean, De Palma is like a god for the French, you know? And I think I got more attention from being associated with him than I did from Star Wars. They revere Brian in France. Herbert Ross, they haven't heard much, I guess they knew the name, but I think he's considered sort of a studio apparatchik or something. But he was a very skillful director. He knew his stuff. He had, of course, a very different sensibility. He had been a dancer and a choreographer. My approach to editing is sort of dance-like. I mean, I love cutting to music. For me, it's the equivalent of dancing. It's the, aspect of editing that's most like most like choreography, whereas choreographers work to organize movement in three-dimensional space against music. Editors organize movement through a two-dimensional plane against music. And it's very similar to choreography, and I enjoy it enormously. Footloose gave me the opportunity to exercise that muscle, that I had done some of that in Phantom of the Paradise, which was partly a musical, but hadn't really had a chance to go full in on that since then. And it was a joy. And it was and a revelation for him too, because I don't think that, I don't know. He was very appreciative, is all I can say.
Mm.
He was married to a ballerina, a woman named Nora Kay, who my mother had been a professional dancer. She had worked in modern dance, and she told me that Nora Kay was one of the two greatest ballerinas she had ever seen in her life. And I told this to Nora, and she said, "Who was the other?"
Who wants to check out the competition?
Yeah, so I asked my mother, I said, who was it? And she said, Pavlova. And I told Nora, she said, "Oh, okay." She was okay with that. She was.
If Pavlova is good enough, then that's the critical criteria correct.
She said, "Oh, okay." Yeah. But Herbert told me that her very first debut, she had 23 curtain calls. She was a huge, huge star as a ballerina. They were married, and she was funny because she was from Brooklyn, I think, and she had this accent. It was sort of like the opposite of what you'd expect from a ballet star. It was very sort of working class New York accent, but she had very refined taste with this funny Brooklyn accent. But anyway, she was very encouraging. She she liked my work, and I think that helped me with Herbert, of course.
And I mean, another person that you bring up in the book, which is a sort of musical hero, is Bernard Herrmann. Although your relationship with him is it doesn't get off to a great start.
No, well, you know, it had been my idea to use Benny's music in Sisters, and I had shown this to Brian and encouraged him. And Benny and I had a misadventure on the mixing stage, which I describe in great detail in my book. But I became persona non grata in his eyes through no fault of my own, I would hasten to add.
Mm.
And after the picture came out, Brian wrote an article in the Village Voice describing how I had championed using Benny's music in the film. And when we met again on the following film that we did, Obsession, his attitude changed 180 degrees, and he was very warm and welcoming. And I assumed that he had read the article, but we became friends, and it was very gratifying.
Mm, absolutely. And I mean, what a career as well, you know, going from...
He was a sheer genius. I mean, his first film was Citizen Kane. His final film was Taxi Driver. So
yeah, I mean, there's not much, you know, you could dream of having a span of a career of which features those films. If it was only those two films, it would be enough. But
you know, when I met him, I thought he was the oldest person, the most ancient person I'd ever met in my life. And he was 61 at the time.
61 in the 70s was old. Nowadays it isn't at all.
No, 61, well, even in those days it wasn't that old, but he was older than his years because he was possessed with a constant and boiling rage that ate him up from inside, I think. He felt the smallest slight was terribly wounding to him, and Hitchcock threw out his score for A Torn Curtain, and he was so hurt by that he left Hollywood and moved to London. So he was, he was a very deeply emotional man, and he paid the price. But, you know, as my father used to say, when he was my age, he'd been dead for 16 years. So it's hard for me to think of him at that age seeming so old to me. But I was 26 at the time, so...
I mean, there are some temperamental, temperamental artists is a sort of almost a bit of a stereotype, but in the filmmaking world, there seems to be almost sometimes an encouragement of that sort of temperamental sort of, you know, I mean, another director who you have a very successful working relationship with, but also, you know, somewhat, well, I think temperamental is a nice way of saying it, is John Hughes, because you have a wonderful rapport with him to begin with, right?
Well, John had this pattern of getting crushes on people. He would he would find somebody, you're the greatest, you know, and then James Spader told me this story that, you know, he had worked for him in Pretty in Pink, and he became friends with him, and he'd go over to the house, and they'd sit in the hot tub together, and they'd stay up all night playing music, and then one day he couldn't get him on the phone. He had no idea why. It was just something that was a pattern of John's that he repeated, that he would get these intense, you know, crush is the best word I can think of on people, and then for no reason he would drop them. So it happened to me, and it happened to a lot of other people too.
And his films were kind of quite challenging as well because of how he was going around shooting and the coverage that he was giving you, right?
Yeah, well, he was a writer, so he was always generating material, I think. I'm not really sure how it happened. The script was long in the first place, and then scene would come in dailies and would be much longer than scene as written on the page. And I think, where did all this material come from? Not sure if he improvised it on the spot or if he wrote overnight and handed out pages in the morning. I'm not really sure how it happened, but I remember going down to the set and speaking to the production, the script supervisor. And I said to her, how's it going? She said, not good. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, the master runs 14 minutes. I said, well, the camera only holds 11 minutes of film. She said, we did a pickup. Scene had 14 minutes. Oh my God.
I mean, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, I always remember watching that. I remember watching it when it first came out. I'm not sure if I saw it on the big screen or if I saw it on video, But it was a very, it felt like a very innovative teen comedy. It was a, you know, it had all those director camera things. And I think you were responsible, if I remember correctly, for the sort of final sting of him staying and ushering people out of the theater.
Well, no, that was John's idea.
Right.
He had shot a number of endings, different endings, but at the same time, it was when they shot the shower sequence, you know, when Matthew's wrapped in a bath towel, they improvised a number of gags that to be played at the end. But in those days, today everybody stays to the end of the movie because they expect to see something at the very end. I think Marvel does that all the time, right? I don't go to Marvel movies, so I'm not sure, but I think that's what they do. And but at that time, the idea of a joke on the end of the titles was, I said, John, nobody's going to see this. Everybody will have left the theater by then. So it occurred to me that there was a scene that we'd taken out, a really funny scene, but in the context of the movie, it was just in the wrong place. So we had dropped the scene for you know, reasons of continuity and not continuity, but pace. And It just didn't make sense where it was originally written. And it was, since it was so funny, I thought maybe we could play that scene against the titles and then people will stick around to watch the scene and then they'll see the tag at the end. So that was my contribution.
Yeah. And I mean, that's, as you say, it's sort of prescient of how films would start utilizing that to keep people in theaters for that little bit longer and see that stuff. How did it, I mean, one of the other films that I was, yeah, I mean, there's so many films, I'd love to talk about all of them, but Falling Down, the Joel Schumacher film, is one of those, that's one of those films that I, every now and again, there's a movie that it's not, I like it, but I it's kind of like it worries me, and I have to go back to the cinema and watch it again, and watch it, you know, two or three times in maybe 1 week. And Falling Down, I was in Liverpool. I remember I went to see that like two or three times because I couldn't quite work out why this film fascinated me so much, and yet in some ways it on paper it shouldn't have.
Well, I think one of the interesting things about Falling Down is the casting. Joel originally sent the script to Michael Douglas to play the part that Duval eventually played. He was the policeman. And Michael Douglas read the script. He says, no, I want to play defense. You know, Joel thought, sure, great. You know, so then you got Duval to play the part that was originally offered to Michael Douglas. But, you know, in the script, defense is this character who, I mean, it's a very interesting character because his reaction to situations that we all find frustrating in life, you know, stuck in traffic or a clerk at a store won't give us change for a dollar so we can make a phone call, or it's past 11 o'clock so we can't order breakfast at the fast food joint. You know, all these little annoyances, petty annoyances that we meet in life, this character would react to violently. So we share his irritation, but we're repelled by his resort to violence. So there's this ambivalence about our feeling to the character, but it's distorted by the star power of Michael Douglas, who's, you know, got the charisma of a movie star. And here he is playing this sort of kind of insane character. And his responses to situations are in sync with ours, but his behavior is aberrant, you know? So it's that push and pull, how you feel about the character, that complicates the story. But I think that's part of what makes it interesting too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it certainly fascinated me. I certainly, you know, there are some films that I wouldn't necessarily put on my sort of top 10 list, but at the same time, just they've got something in them that you keep having to go back to and trying to solve and trying to, you know, so, and that's one I definitely had that with. So as you're sort of established at this point, you also have a moment where you sort of go back to work with Brian for Mission Impossible, and then also later Mission to Mars, and I mean, one thing that's that I got the feeling, and maybe I'm wrong, but when I was reading your book, I got the feeling that it didn't seem like the industry, you have this point that you're only as good as your last picture, and it's kind of Pluto Nash kind of puts you in a bad position, even though you've had all these huge successes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really, it feels really unforgiving of the industry and really, really ungrateful, I should say.
Well, I have this line that I give people. I say, you know, when something bad happens to them, they get fired or whatever, I say, they'll take it personally. They don't consider you a person. So you can't, if you want to work in the business, you have to develop a sort of a thick skin. But there's no illusions about it, I don't think. I mean, people know that Hollywood tends to be kind of cynical and ignorant, you know. People don't know your resume. I mean, just because I've done all these films doesn't mean that the people I'm working with know it. Some do, some don't. I remember I was working on a picture called The Fighting Temptations, and the head of the studio at the time was a woman named Sherry Lansing. And Sherry, we'd had a screening and a preview, and she had some notes, and she came to the cutting room and we showed her the change, and she was very happy. And she was there with a couple of her other assistants, executives, junior executives. Mm. And she started sort of making a point about preview screenings. And she said, you know, she turned to me in order to make a point. She said, for instance, what's the most successful picture you ever worked on? I said, Star Wars. And she stopped dead in her tracks because clearly that was not what she had hoped I would say.
It was not in line with the argument that she was trying to make. It
wasn't helping her point, I guess. I don't know what her point was, but certainly, and she just stopped. She said, you had to go and say Star Wars. I said, you asked me, you know? So that's what I mean, that people don't necessarily know, you know, you don't walk around with a resume on your back, you know, so it doesn't really matter what your past successes have been. People may not know it, you know.
But it just feels like such a fundamental part of making a movie. And I mean, I look at editors Thelma Schumacher with Martin Scorsese or Sally Menke with the early Quentin Tarantino. And I sort of think, you know, there's a moment where, tragically, Sally Menke dies, that I don't think it's a coincidence Tarantino's films sort of drop off in quality after that. You know, I think it just seems so essential that the directors have great editors behind them. Why isn't that appreciated? Why isn't that, you know, that should be, you know, nailed into the system.
Yeah, well, you know, directors have massive egos and they don't like the idea that they're sharing credit for anything with anyone. That's part of it. I don't know. The other thing is that as far as Tarantino's concerned, Brian made the point to me that directors don't get better as they age. You know, their best films are done in their prime of life, not at the end. And it's true of Hitchcock, his films got worse. And it's true of most directors that they hit a peak and then, you know, their last films are, you know, like it happened with De Palma, you know, his later films were not as good as his earlier films. And it can be true of Tarantino too. Brian says that directors are remembered for the films they did in their 30s. It's possibly true, but I realized recently, something I've known all my life, but I never thought about it, was that the editor is the one person on the film with whom the director works most closely. The collaboration with the editor is more than with any of the other people on the picture. And it's more extended and closer than with anyone else. So I don't know what that's particularly germane to your point, but yeah, these films are not made by robots. You know, every movie you see is handmade. Every splice or cut, now it's not a splice anymore, but every cut is a choice made by a person. And every person has personal predilections and styles and so forth. So every picture you see is a handmade film by someone, and it's usually the editor, and the director will come in and make adjustments to bring it closer to his or her sensibility. But the editor is making a lot of choices, many more choices than is possible to change, except, of course, on Star Wars, where we basically changed every choice. But usually these films are, you know, made by the editor and adjusted by the director.
I guess that's what I mean, is just that, you know, you're spending millions of dollars most of the time, multi-millions of dollars on a film. And then, you know, one of the principal, most important jobs about putting that together and the final product, presenting it, and you're not checking the person's CV, you're not casting the editor with the same care that you would cast the lead actor, or the same care that you would cast, you know, you would hire anybody who's going to have that fundamental an effect on the film. You know,
I would take issue with that. I think the director is very careful about who they hire. I mean, especially because you're going to be spending so many hours with that person, you know.
So it's more the studio than the directors is what I kind of meant, I guess.
No, it's not. It's the director who hires the editor. Unless, of course, the director goes off course, and then the studio, you know, will bring somebody in. That's sort of what happened to me later in my career, which is that I got fewer offers from directors, but I started getting offers from producers and studio executives to come in and fix something that they thought wasn't working.
Yeah. How did you feel about that work? How did you, was there a different set of challenges that were interesting for you?
Well, I feel, you know, there's a certain ambivalence about it. You want to work on good pictures.
Right.
So it's not fun to work on something that's not a good picture. Yet if you can improve it, there's a sense of satisfaction about that, you know, and you know, there's an ego satisfaction coming in to save the day. You know, you feel very smart if you can manage to pull it off. But I say it as a joke, but it's partially true. I say I did it for the money. You know, you have to make a living in this world, and you take whatever jobs come along.
Sure.
If the job isn't coming from the director and it comes from a producer, you take that job, you know. So a certain reality about earning a living in the world that you have to adjust to.
And when you had the opportunity then to sort of, you sat and you wrote your memoir and you were sort of looking back, was there anything that sort of surprised you in the process of going over your career and your life?
Well, I started to realize that a lot of my relationships with directors had ended badly. I thought maybe there's something I was doing that was contributing to that, you know. But I argue with directors. I feel, I don't know if it's arrogance or whatever, I've always felt to be the intellectual equal of whomever I'm working with. Not always true. There's some, you know, I think they have gifts that I don't have, certainly, and I definitely acknowledge that. But in terms of, you know, discussions about the work, I feel, you know, sort of, I've always felt sort of on an equal footing and debated them. When I disagreed with them, I felt the obligation to pursue my opinion until they shut it down, because I feel it's doing them a service that if their ideas are put to the test in discussions with me, they can go into, you know, more public situations with the confidence of knowing that their ideas have been tested. So even if I disagree with them, I feel I'm doing them a service. But they may not have agreed with that. So Mission to Mars sort of ended badly with Brian and I sort of on the outs, but we've made up since then, and I'm happy to report that our relationship's on a good footing again. But, you know, Hughes sort of cut me off, and Herbert Ross was unhappy with, I wanted to take a vacation with my children, and he was unhappy with my going away for a week. But, you know, I'm sure I would have gotten more work from Brian if we'd stayed on the same coast. But I moved to the West Coast. He stayed in New York. So he hired me when he did a picture on the West Coast, like Mission Impossible or Mission to Mars. Those were West Coast productions, and he hired me for those. And the same is true with Herbert. I mean, Herbert moved to New York after Steel Magnolias. He did one more picture. I think the one with Steve Martin. Can't remember. It's about a mafia boss who's in.
Oh, is it My Blue Heaven? Is that
My Blue Heaven? So, yeah. So I think he, you know, after he did that, he moved to New York and married Jackie Kennedy's sister. So and then Hughes retired. Basically, he stopped editing films. He just stopped directing films after Curly Sue, I think. I think that was his last one. So at a certain point, all the directors I'd worked with had either retired or passed away. So you start having to work with new people, and it's always a roll of the dice.
Yeah, and you sort of become, you know, the... you know, the directors are getting younger, just like the policemen these days.
Yeah. Yeah.
Listen, there's one final question I want to ask Paul, and you've been very generous with your time, so I really appreciate that. But the one final question is, we always ask for a recommendation for a book, because this is a podcast about books, about people writing about film specifically. What would you like to recommend for our listeners?
Oh gosh, you put me on the spot here. I don't read a lot about film. Let me look at my shelf here. Well, there's there's Walter Murch's book, a very slim book. Walter approaches editing from more of a scientific standpoint. I tend to see it as sort of an instinctive art. I think Walter has a more scientific slant on editing, which is very interesting. I would recommend his book, In the Blink of an Eye.
I haven't read that one. I read his book he did with Michael Ondaatje, the Conversations, which was a very interesting, very interesting book. When you watch a movie nowadays, do you sort of watch a movie with a sort of the professional eye and go, oh, that's well edited, or vice versa?
Yeah, I do.
Who are the editors working at the moment that you sort of admire?
Oh, there's a number of them. There's a man named Tom Cross who did Whiplash, I believe. Very talented. Eddie Hamilton has taken over the Mission Impossible franchise. He's an excellent editor. He also worked on Maverick. And who else? My daughter, Gina Hirsch, excellent editor. She's waiting for her first big hit. I keep telling her, you're one hit away from stardom. That's the way it works.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Herbert Ross used to always say that. It's all hits and flops. Hits and flops. That's all it's about. Hits and flops.
Absolutely. That's a brilliant. Thank you so much, Paul, for talking to me. I really appreciate it. And it's been really interesting, fascinating talking to you.
Well, that's great. It's been fun talking to you.
Okay, that was my conversation with Paul Hirsch. It was a fascinating and a great honor, in fact, to talk to the man who had such an impact on so many of the films that formed my love of cinema. So I'm very grateful that he took the time to do that. His book is wonderful. If you haven't already read it, I'm sure this conversation will have encouraged you to go out and get a copy. A long time ago, in a cutting room far, far away, my 50 years editing Hollywood hits, Star Wars, Carrie, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Mission Impossible, and much, much more. A quick note would be that next week there won't be an episode. I am away at a film festival, so it's unlikely that there will be an episode. So I think we're going to have a short break, hopefully just a week, maybe 2 weeks, before we're back. If you are hankering after some Writers on Film talk, there are over 80 episodes to go back to and discover some great guests if you haven't heard them all, and if you have, you might want to go back and revisit a couple, because some of those conversations are well worth delving into. Thanks go to Ali Howard for the artwork and to Elliot Atkins for the music, and thank you, dear listener, for joining me, and hopefully you'll be here again soon. Take care. Thank you.
This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.